Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and time to talk taxes, your taxes, with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals, they consult other tax professionals, and teach tax seminars around the country. As we talk with Mary, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about filing your taxes? Maybe you changed jobs this year. Maybe you're wondering what you need to do. Join the conversation. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's nice to be inside where it's warm.
It definitely is. And as we think about our tax returns, maybe the first obvious question, when's the 24 tax return due?
24 tax return, the unextended tax return for most of us in this area is due April 15th. And I say that because we have friends in the North Carolina, Florida, California area that will have differing dates for those. But for anybody in our area, it's April 15th is the unextended due date.
You know, just recently there was some news about the IRS mailing out $1,400 payments to some of us. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, IRS is still catching up from COVID. So these are payments that either apparently people did not claim on their 2021 tax return that yielded, or they weren't in the cycle because they had Social Security payments or whatever. They apparently did not get the $1,400 at that time. So IRS is trying to find the people that didn't get the $1,400 and send them out. So part of it is if you get a check for $1,400 and you didn't get it before, it's yours. If you got it and you got it before, don't spend it because they are likely when they catch up with it, they'll ask for it back.
Okay. I know you wanted to talk about earned income credit today on the show, and maybe start by what is earned income credit or EIC?
Earned income credit is a credit or extra money paid to taxpayers who have low income. And it used to always be you have to have earnings and you have to have children. Several years ago, the IRS added for low income people who have no children an opportunity and a job. An opportunity to collect this credit. And it is a refundable credit. So people who have jobs, maybe don't owe any income tax, but have a low income, earnings, and usually children, can qualify for earned income credit. It is an area of tax that sometimes is done incorrectly. The Inspector General for Tax Administration, TIGDA, is a part of the government that is kind of a watchdog on the IRS. And they report to Congress with studies during the year. One recently happened regarding money that was paid out by the IRS that was improper payments, either paid too much, paid to the wrong person, you know, not qualified people. In the earned income credit world, 33% of the payments that go out for earned income credit, the government believes are incorrect. With that being said, IRS has, over the past few years, has penalties for tax return preparers who do them wrong and is very watchful of that area. There is, for us as practitioners, if we grant earned income credit without doing proper due diligence, we could face a $500 fine indexed for inflation, so it's higher than that. There's also a special form that we have to attest to that we've asked all the right questions. But people who do that, to do it on their own, do not go through that due diligence. So if it's wrong, it's up to the IRS, you know, to find that out. For the person who purposely does it, they can go 10 years without being able to claim the credit. If you make a mistake on it, you could give up the credit for being able to claim it for two years. So it's a serious thing. The IRS has put off, in the past it used to be that people who claimed that got to file their tax return as soon as the government accepted it, and they would get the money back. It also opened the door for people who fraudulently did it to do it as well. To that end, the IRS will accept the earned income credit returns, but they will not process them until the middle of February, and the first checks usually come out somewhere about the 27th of February. So if you are in the earned income category and you're wondering, I filed, where's my return? It may be it's a result of that particular credit taking longer.
So, you know, you want to be careful for sure, as you're indicating. How do you know if you qualify? I mean, where can you check?
The IRS has wonderful publications. They have charts that walk through what you need to know to claim the earned income credit. So I would recommend to someone who does their own tax return, whether they do it by paper or one of the softwares that are available. And last time we talked about the IRS having a new program called Direct File.
Yeah.
And if you go to the IRS website, type in earned income credit, there are publications, there are fact sheets, there is all kinds of information if you want to do it correctly. And, of course, we all recommend you do it correctly.
For sure. I understand there's a change to Wisconsin's child care tax credit. What's new with that?
Well, Wisconsin is generous. Or to start as a background, the federal government has had a child care credit for years. And over the years, they've changed things. And during the pandemic, the expenses that you were able to use, the dollar amount, went up. After the pandemic legislation settled down, they went back to credit based on $3,000 for one child and $6,000 for two or more children. In that time, Wisconsin started out with a tax deduction rather than a credit. And a couple of years ago, the state of Wisconsin went to kind of a mirror, using the federal credit as a basis and taking 50% of that. This year, they have raised that to 100% of the federal credit, but they have also changed the amount of expenses that are allowed. So for one child, you can claim up to $10,000 of expenses. The common credit is a 20% credit. And for two or more children, it's $20,000 of expenses. So they have Wisconsin credits generally will be better than the federal credit, unless you spent less than $3,000 or $6,000 of money. Then it will be the same as the federal credit.
Okay. You mentioned that direct file, free file, the IRS has something called that. How do these programs work?
Okay. In the past, the IRS made a deal with software vendors and said, we want to make sure that lower income people could do a tax return without having to pay for it. That was a free file program, and there were several vendors that agreed to buy into that, and you went to the IRS website and it directed you to one of the vendors at your choice. In one of the past recent legislations, Congress said, IRS, we want you to create your own software. And so they did. And last year, they had a test pilot program for about 6 weeks at the end of tax season. The IRS created the program to the tune of, I believe, $24.6 million to create this software program and report to Congress and file the tax returns. There were 147,000 people that took advantage of it in 12 states last year. IRS is now ready to open it up to any states that wanted to participate. Wisconsin is one that is participating. So you can go to the IRS website, look for direct file, and file a tax return through them.
Is there any minimum income or maximum income? I mean, who can qualify on that?
One of the most important things is IRS is very conscious of identity theft. So in order to even consider using it, to do it, you have to set up what's called an ID.me account. And an ID.me account helps you authenticate who you are when you go in to use the program and maybe, you know, go back to it. So it's not a whole lot different than when you go to your bank and they have to send a code to you through your phone to be able to get into your system. It's a protection device. But anyone who wants to use direct file will need to set up an account. If they already have an ID.me account for something else, like Social Security, that will work fine. That being said, it is meant not based on income level, but rather kinds of income. So you can be, you can have a job and have a W-2. You can have be retired and have a 1099-R that you're receiving, Social Security, interest. And if you live in Alaska, the Alaska dividends the Alaskan community gets. And that's basically it for income. You can't have dividends, you can't have a rental property, you can't have a business to use it. So it is at a select group of people. There are a few adjustments. You cannot use Schedule A. You have to use a standard deduction. You can claim the earned income credit that we talked about, the child tax credit, and the additional child tax credit, and the child care credit. You cannot claim the education credit using it. So when you go into it, you have to authenticate yourself, and you also go through a system that says, do you qualify to use the program? There were many people that tried to use it last year and did not qualify for it. So that's a step. It doesn't work for everybody. If it does work for you, you know, it's like going to one of the other software vendors that people use, except it's through the IRS directly.
Hmm. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. You can join in with your tax questions. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on the show. Larry Mueller here. After 12:30, we'll talk about how to get your well water tested. Right now, though, we're talking taxes with Mary Mellon of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals in the Green Bay area. Great to have her with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call. Ron in Wolf River, it's your turn. Hi, Ron. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Mary and Larry. Timely show, as always. Really great. I have a question on Roth conversions. And we have many reportable distributions that are only reported once a year after the year is over, like bank interest and dividends. when we do a Roth conversion during the year, is it treated differently than these other distributions? And is there a requirement to pay estimated taxes on the Roth conversions when they occur earlier in the year?
Good question, Ron. A Roth conversion is moving deferred retirement, the IRA, into a Roth IRA. The Roth IRA, just background, is the IRA that you pay taxes on when you put the money in, but the earnings grow tax-free when you take it out. There is no tax at that point. What you will receive if you make a Roth conversion is a 1099-R showing the amount as a taxable event. It is a taxable event. It is reported on the 8606 page 2 to claim that income. It is also, if you are under the age of 59 and a half, it is not something that is subject to the 10% penalty. But you should receive that a distribution, 1099-R distribution, and report it just as if you had taken the money out. It's just the 8606 will say where that money went.
There you go, Ron. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Kay called, couldn't stay with us. Mary Kay says, just wanted to add something. She says a non-custodial parent can claim their children if they leave a release or revoke note with the 8332 form because they're paying child support.
Oh, there's way too much in that that I think she needs to check it out. There's some other issues in there about who's actually claiming the child. Again, I suggest for people who have questions about earned income credit, you have to have the child or have released the child and in order to claim earned income credit. It does not go to the non-custodial parent who has received the child based on giving up, you know, giving up the parent giving up the right to claim that child. So if in doubt, go to the IRS website, take a look at the chart that says who qualifies for it.
Mary in New London, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. My father passed away in 2023, and he had a IRA retirement account. His minimum required withdrawal was taken before his death, and the remainder of the IRA was transferred to me and my siblings. Three of us took our shares from that fund in 2023. One of my siblings did not, and he was calling me asking that he had been told that he needs to take a required minimum withdrawal from the amount that's still in that account, and was told by someone that that withdrawal had to continue to be made for 10 years after my father's death. Just wondering what is correct?
It's a good, very good question, Mary. I'm glad that you asked it. Back in 2019, there was legislation called the Secure Act. The Secure Act extended the time for our retired RMD distributions from 70 and a half out to 72, and finally, right now we're at 73. If your father died after he was already taking RMDs, it means that anybody who inherited an account from him, inherited IRA, had to continue to take RMDs from that account. Now, that was a given rule for inherited IRAs, period. In the old days, if you inherited an IRA, you had to take an RMD. The SECURE Act changed that and said, if you inherit an IRA, you have to take it out within 10 years of the person's death. Now, when the regulations came out 2 years later, they said, but we forgot to tell you, if the person who you inherited from in 2022 or later was already taking RMDs out, you have to continue to take an RMD each year, still taking out the whole thing within 10 years. So the information your brother was given is correct. Now, let me just put one little thing into it. IRS said in 2022, they came out with these regulations in February, and they said, we didn't give you enough time. You don't have to take it for 2020, or we won't penalize you if you didn't take it for 2021 or 2022. In 23, they came out and said, okay, we'll let you go for this year. And this past year, they again said, we won't. You are supposed to take it out, but we won't penalize you if you didn't take it out. The penalty for not taking RMDs when you should have is 25%, general rule. But it is correct, the information they gave him. And for 2025, we expect that they're not going to waive the penalty.
So what about Mary and the other siblings who took the money in 2023? Are they going to have to go back?
No. Okay. In 2023, if they took it out, they're done with it. They cleared out their part of it. They paid taxes on it. Our retirement accounts, IRAs, when you inherit them, are not like some people think inheritance, that you don't have to pay taxes on inheritance. Our retirement accounts are what we call income in respect of a decedent, which means that it is taxable to the heir in the same way that it would have been taxable to the decedent. So presumably they cleared their account out, they paid taxes on it, they're out of it. The brother has his share of the account to deal with. And in 10 years from dad's death, it has to be cleared out or there will be penalties.
Mary, does that help out?
It does, but if he removes his share, will he still have to do the required distribution?
The idea of the RMD is only if there is money in that account at the end of the prior year, you have to take some of it out in the current year. If you clean the account out, that's it.
You'll have to pay taxes on it, but that's it.
Yes.
Okay. Mary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. A listener emailed us. They've had conflicting advice from two accountants regarding member draws or member distributions. One told them to never take a draw from the SCORP status, while another told them it's fine and one of the reasons SCORPs are more valuable to the company.
I've never heard, I believe that they're talking about S-corporations.
Oh, S-corp.
The only thing that I've never heard an S-corp referred to as a SCORP before, but I believe that that's what they're talking about as distributions.
Okay. So
here's the deal, that people who are shareholders of an S-corp or partners in a partnership sometimes get confused about the taxation. If you are a shareholder or a partner, it is what's called a pass-through entity. The entity itself does not pay income tax. It passes through the income to the shareholders or partners. They will pay taxes on it as a pass-through. They will pay taxes on it whether they take any actual money in their hands or not. Member distributions are a way of getting money out of that you have already paid taxes on. You have what's called the cost basis in your partnership interest or in your S corporation. You will be paying taxes on money you did not receive. If you take money out that you have already paid taxes on, you will not pay taxes on it a second time. That distribution will reduce your basis in the property. If things have increased beyond it, maybe because of earnings or something like that, and you take out more than your basis, the extra will be taxable to you. But there are reasons to leave it in there. There are reasons to take it out. It's just, it's a situation by situation basis.
Let's take a question from Ann in Madison. Ann, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've got a question about estimated taxes. I'm really unfamiliar with this. When are they required? Under what circumstances? And is there some kind of deadline for them?
Good question. First of all, estimated tax payments are quarterly payments. They are due April 15th, June 15th, October 15th, September 15th, and January 15th. There are four quarterly estimates. The reason people make estimated tax payments is generally because they have no other way, like withholding. They don't have or haven't taken opportunity to have withholding. The government goes on the basis that you pay as you go. So if you owe the government money, they want it evenly, theoretically, evenly throughout the year. So if I get to the end of the year and I owe the government $1,500, if I owe them money, they will charge me a penalty for not having paid it timely during the year. Timely is 1/4 of it, or roughly, per quarter. Each quarter stands on its own. People who pay estimates generally are people who do not have estimated, have withholding sources. So if I own a business, I don't have a, because of the business, I don't pay income tax in through withholding. So I would want to make estimates to pay my income and self-employment tax. If I'm retired and I have a lot of investments, well, whether I'm retired or not, but if I have a lot of investment income, that income does not have withholding on it generally. Rental properties may also be something like that. The government says we can charge you a penalty when you owe a balance due unless you have paid 100% of last year's taxes in or 90% of the current year's taxes. So the reason to file estimates is to avoid paying additional in the way of underpayment penalties. Does that help?
That help?
Yeah, I don't know. It still sounds kind of confusing.
Have income that you can have withholding taken, like Social Security, retirement distributions, or wages from your job.
So if I increase my withholding, that should help.
Yes. If you owe a balance to the IRS at the end of the year and you have the ability to have withholding, then increase your withholding so that you get closer to zero. As long as you owe the government under $1,000 at the end of the year, you will not incur a penalty. But if it's over that, or you do not pay timely, you know, you try to pay everything in April, then they will charge you an underpayment penalty.
Yeah. And I had the same problem that might have last year on my taxes. I hadn't taken out enough or had enough withheld, and so I got stuck with a penalty. So, I mean, that was the year before. So this past year, I changed my withholding, but I also did an estimated tax for the first quarter to make sure that I was covered. To be perfectly honest,
that's a smart way of doing things. Nobody likes to pay taxes. It is a consequence of having what we have. We have to do it. But paying the penalty is usually something we can do something about to avoid that.
Yeah. And there you go. Good luck. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jean in Mount Horeb couldn't stay with us. She owns land that's rented separately to a farmer and then secondly to a hunter. What form or forms on the income tax does she use? Does she use separate forms for the hunter and the farmer, or can she lump them?
There is rental of property is reported on a Schedule E. There is room for three different properties on the Schedule E. So if it's strictly land rental, then each address, so to speak, would have its own column on the Schedule E. If, however, if she's renting to farmer and she has any control over what the farmer produces on that land, then that's a special kind of farm rental that is reported on a 4835. But she would have to be dealing with the farmer about what kind of product he's going to put in there, you know, and yeah, have maybe the land rental based on how much was raised on the property. But simply, if you're renting per acre, it belongs on a Schedule E as one of the entries on the Schedule E.
All right. Michael in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Michael.
Hi there. I was wondering if you have a partnership LLC. Actually, I got two questions. The partnership LLC and your ending business, is there somebody with the government that you have to let know, or do you just stop doing business?
Okay. Let me see if I understand. You were in a partnership, an LLC partnership, and you discontinue the partnership. Is that correct?
Starting this year, yes. Well, we're stopping doing business.
Stopping doing business in 2025 or 2024?
2025.
Okay. From an income tax perspective, when you stop doing business as a partnership, then you need to do a final partnership return. The partnership return is due by the 15th day of the third month after you stop your business. So I say that because it doesn't go to its normal due date if you stop business during the middle of the year. Now, that being said, if you are done with the LLC, not to be holding on to it for use with anything else, you would notify the Wisconsin Department of Financial Finance. It's the place that you would have registered your LLC to begin with, and you would be terminating your interest. On the tax return, you would be marking final, but you also have a reporting to them that you should be closing out your association with the financial institutions is the department. And also, if you have a BTR number with the state, like sales tax or employment tax, you need to notify the Department of Revenue that these are your final returns.
All right. Michael, you had a second question?
Yeah, I was told by somebody that if you have an LLC, instead of doing a flow-through, so you're doing a company tax return and a personal one, that you can just do a personal. Now, is that true for an S-Corp, and is it for an LLC?
Okay. First of all, an LLC is not an entity that's recognized by the IRS as a separate entity. An LLC will be one of four things, technically. It could be a single-member LLC. We call it a disregarded entity. And that is reported on your personal income tax return. So an LLC could be a Schedule C business that is called ABC LLC. And if one person owns it, a single member LLC, it's reported through your Schedule C on your personal tax return. If, however, you have a multi-member LLC, then it defaults to being a partnership, and you would do a Form 1065 that will flow for that partner, their share to their personal return. But the 1065 has to be done for the LLC. If you are an LLC, a multi-member LLC, and you elect to be treated as an S-Corp, then the LLC will file a 1120S form, and it will be an entity, but its income for that shareholder or shareholders flows back to their personal return. And then the last one is you could have an LLC that you choose to be taxed as a C corporation, and you'd file an 1120. So the information that was given to you is partly correct. The only way it goes only on your personal return is if it is a single-member disregarded LLC.
All right. Michael, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. Mary Mellum, our guest tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, our guest today talking your taxes. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking your taxes today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, and Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her back with us. We had an email from B, who was notified in 2024 that B had miscalculated the 2022 federal income taxes. When B looked at the records, they had indeed miscalculated the amount of taxes they paid in. The amount of unpaid taxes and interest were due on October 16th, 2024. On October 10th, they mailed the full amount due, but the IRS claims they didn't receive the payment until the 17th, one day late. Is there anything they can do about the penalty of $169 the IRS says they owe for being a day late? B says the situation seems unfair since it was mailed October 16th.
That's a nice question. The way IRS calculates the underpayment penalty is on a monthly basis. So if it is not received by them by, it's usually the 15th, maybe the 15th was on a Saturday or Sunday and it went to the 16th, but they will assess that underpayment, the failure to pay penalty based on a monthly basis. So if it's the failure to pay penalty and not interest, that will be based on a monthly basis. Any day that you tip over into that next month, you will owe that penalty. You can always ask to have them waive it. It would require either a conversation with someone at the IRS or a letter. I mean, she's always welcome to ask for that, and they may consider it, but it's received unlike the tax return, which is considered, they consider the postal date on that, when it comes to paying back taxes or penalty assessment, it's when it's received by them, not when it's mailed.
Perry in Oconto has a question for us. Hi, Perry.
Hello, and thanks, Mary. Is there a way to deduct from your taxes an expired stock warrant, the ability to purchase shares that they expired?
If you paid for something, if you have a basis in it and you did not exercise that stock, then your cost is a deductible. That would be your loss on it. So you would report it on 8949, zero sales price, and whatever your investment that you did not recover for it.
All right, Perry, there you go. Thank you for calling. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I wanted to know if it's possible to do any tax deductions for someone starting to write their book. And I've joined a writing group with a writing coach, things like that, any expenses. And I've converted our dining room into my writing room, you know, with my bookcases in there and my laptop and my computer. So I just had that question. What, if anything, can be deducted?
Pat, have you ever published anything before this?
I've published academic things like articles and stuff like that, and also some articles in local magazines, but not a book.
Okay. Basically, the IRS, when you start a business and you have not actually gone into business, the costs of going into business are captured and then can be written off once you start your business. Writing a book, or an author gets an exception to that. If you are an author, then you get to deduct expenses kind of as you go. Capitalization is the term I was looking for. Normally, we capitalize our expenses and then deduct them once we start getting income. There was a court case years ago about an IRS agent, and he wrote a book, did extensive research in Las Vegas. The topic of the book was brothels, and the court case allowed him to deduct those expenses currently because they felt that his position with the IRS was that of an author, that he wrote things through them. So it appears that if you have been published before, that you would meet the definition of an author and you could write off certain costs that you would have. Now, office and home is not one of those because you have to have income to be able to deduct office and home. So I would say I would probably, on the conservative side, not even worry about that until you start seeing a return on your investment. But your cost of keeping your computer up, certainly paper, you know, doing the things that you would need to write your book, those costs, if you have been an author before, you should be able to deduct those costs.
Pat, there you go. I have an author friend who was able, who had been an author for quite a while and did some research in Ireland for a book and was able to deduct some of those expenses from her taxes, the trip and so forth. Gianni in Montello, your turn. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good morning, Mary and Larry. Listen, I do, H&R Block does my accounting, and in early December, I received a notice that I had to register my LLC. There was a new edict from the federal government that they wanted me to register, and I did so. Now I'm told that that edict has been rescinded, and my efforts, which were considerable, several hours, to go online and register this, were to naught. It was not necessary. Has this edict been rescinded?
Okay. What you're talking about is the Corporate Transparency Act. As the Corporate Transparency Act said that if you are a person, an owner of a business that has registered with the state, and that was the Office of Financial Institutions I mentioned earlier. It covers LLCs, it covers corporations, any entity that had to register with that. And it's, like I said, LLCs and corporations, some trusts. The rule said, and it was a law that said that if you had a certain ownership or you were the person in charge and you were one of these entities, you had to go to the FinCEN department, FinCEN.org, and register your business. I'm surprised it took you 3 hours. I don't think it should have taken that long, but in reading it and things. And also, there are people that are willing to do it for you that will charge you. There is no charge for you to do it yourself on the line. But if you have someone help you with it, and there are scams out there with that. But here's the status of it. It is something that has gone before the courts, and some states, the court's jurisdiction in some states said it was unconstitutional, and for some of those states, they did not have to go with it until it was settled. There was a court case in Texas called Texas Top Cop that said nobody has to do it. And that was what came out of their case. That was in, I think, the beginning of December. The Supreme Court, or it is going to appeals. Bottom line is that they have put a stay on it temporarily. There isn't an answer to it, and we are recommending that if you are in that situation, that you register. We don't know what's going to come out of it, but if they decide that it is constitutional, based on the last turnover, and it has gone and turned over again, they gave 12 extra days. Now, 12 days is not a lot of extra time to be notified and get it done. And there are penalties for not doing it when all the dust settles. So I wouldn't say you've done it for naught. And you can't get back the 3 hours you lost, but it didn't cost you any money, or it didn't have to cost you any money.
Gianni, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Mary Mellum, our guest, tax professional from Green Bay, who has been in the tax business for more than 30 years. She owns Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Quick note, tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about the effort to reduce the use of road salt in the winter, and then we'll talk to the creators of a movie set in Wisconsin, and it's titled Green and Gold. But taxes on our minds now. Stay with us. We're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the WPR News. Jeez, I forgot the title. Talk at WPR News. I'm Larry Kneeler. Talking taxes on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Great to have her with us. And there are lots of callers online and lots of emails, so I think we'll get right to it. And go to Deb in Franklin first. Deb, hello. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I had a question with regard to estimated tax payments. I'm retired, and I took money out of my pre-tax accounts last year. And I did make estimated tax payments to both the feds and the state. My question is, will I get a tax form from either one of those or both of those stating how much I paid in total?
Good question, Deb, but the answer is no. You should be keeping a record of the estimated tax payments that you made and the date you paid them. Wisconsin does have an estimated tax lookup site that if you go to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue and you type in estimated tax payments, you can look up under your Social Security number how much you've paid and when they received them. So federal doesn't have that same courtesy, but Wisconsin does. But you will not get anything recounting how much you've paid them.
There you go, Deb. Thank you for calling. Judy in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi there. I have an LLC that I registered in 24. However, I've had no activity, neither income nor expenses in 24. Do I need to report that?
For income tax purposes, if you haven't had any expenses with it, any income or any expenses that you are eligible to claim, there's nothing really to report. You know, you'd have, I'm assuming your LLC is for a business?
Yes.
If, like I say, if you had any activity, either expenses or income, you should do the Schedule C for it. But if you didn't have anything, there's nothing that you have to report because there's nothing the government would see.
Judy, there you go. Thank you for calling. Rich in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Rich.
Hello. I'm a first-time homebuyer, and I was wondering if there was any tax credits or anything I could do on my taxes this year.
So you bought your home in 2024?
Correct.
Okay.
There is no first-time home buyer credit as such, and this year is the last year, 2024, that the people who did take advantage of the first-time home buyer credit back in 2008, this is the last year that they have the 500 payback that they had, just an aside. But currently, we do not have a first-time home buyer credit. However, depending on how much your mortgage is or property taxes, you may be able to itemize. It's harder to itemize today, but that's one of the benefits of buying a home. And the other thing to remember on the state of Wisconsin, there is a property tax credit, a rent credit, property tax credit. And when you own your home, the amount of taxes that you've paid during the year goes towards providing that credit. So those are the things that I would say that you need to look into for this year.
Rich, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Mary in Holman, Wisconsin. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a question. I had taken out some stock, cash in some stock. I need to have some work done on the house. And this is stock that I have held since like early 70s. And it's just been reinvesting. A company that I used to work for.
Okay.
So when they look at that, like if I'm going to get charged like a capital gains tax, is it based on what I originally paid for that stock and then what it's selling for now?
I see your question, Mary, as asking what's my basis in the stock. I'm assuming this was stock you owned outside of a retirement program. Is that true?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. So you own the stock, you sold the stock, you will get a 1099-B reporting the proceeds that you have received. The taxability of it is the difference between the proceeds you received and your cost basis in that stock, plus any selling expenses that you might have incurred with it. The stock basis is what you originally paid for it, plus the reinvested dividends that you would have paid taxes on as dividends. So if it's ABC stock and it's held by a broker and you have reinvestments, every time it pays a dividend, you would be charged income tax on that dividend, but you never took the money in your hand. You told them buy more stock with it. Then that's all part of your cost basis.
So does the brokerage firm, I think, don't they have to mail you statements by March 15th at the latest?
Basically, yes. I mean, in theory, I think it's maybe February 15th, but brokerage statements, they get exceptions and things like that. They're usually out by mid-March. Now, brokers, depending on when she acquired that stock, a broker may have to keep track of the cost basis of it. So there is possibly records of that. And back in, I believe it was 2012, the brokers were required to have cost basis. And so it may, your brokerage statement might come in with that cost basis. But check that number just in case it doesn't reflect what you paid to the original company, just these reinvestments.
Any tricks or tips for reading what can be a pretty boring document, to be honest?
The brokerage statement?
Yeah.
It is an important document, and what I tell people, don't just look at the first page. Your consolidated brokerage statements that come from your big brokers have a lot of stuff on page one. You know, they'll tell you what the interest you earn, the dividends in another box, and it'll tell you about the overall capital gains. But you need to go behind that and look at each transaction. And if you have multiple transactions, each one of them and the date for it should be listed there. It's just something that you have to look through it and maybe even ask your broker questions if it seems like Greek.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. Joan emailed, could you please tell Joan what expenses are deductible when fostering an animal for an animal rescue group? What kinds of documents are needed for taxes?
If you are fostering an animal and not being paid anything for it, and you are doing it for that charitable organization, either like the Humane Society would be a 501c3, the only deductions that I could see would be the charitable deduction, and it would be any expenses like food or supplies that you would need to foster that animal, anything that's coming out of your pocket that you are doing in the name of this charity would be a charitable deduction. I would certainly look for some kind of paperwork from, I would save my receipts for anything I purchased, and I would look for some kind of paperwork that made you responsible for those kinds of things from that organization. And then lastly, in order to take advantage of charitable contributions, you would need to be itemizing using the Schedule A on your tax return. If you do standard deduction for federal purposes, there's no benefit. There is an itemized deduction credit on Wisconsin that sometimes people who take the standard on federal are able to take this credit on Wisconsin, but again, it depends on your situation.
Yeah. And, you know, just take it one step further. What if you switch brokerage firms during the year, for example?
If you switch brokerage firms, going back to the prior question,
yeah.
If you switch brokerage firms, the brokers, after the 2012-2014 law, the brokers are supposed to share information with each other. When they transfer the money from one brokerage firm to another, they're supposed to transfer the records of basis from 2012 and forward. So it should be there. But you are ultimately responsible for your cost basis information. Just keep that in mind.
Bill sent us an email. Why are taxpayers 65 and older discriminated against with EITC? Which I'm trying to remember what that stands for.
EITC is just another way of saying EIC.
Oh.
Bill, what you're referring to is the fact that you qualify for earned income credit if, let's see, I'm thinking, did I get this confused with the savers credit? The earned income credit was designed for working people that have children. And so I'm not sure if his discrimination is with the working people or the fact that you have children. I don't believe that EIC is the one with the timing. There is the savers credit, I believe, is between 25 and 65. But earned income credit, I don't believe it has any age level. So if you do not have children and make a minimum amount of money, I can think of what he might be thinking. There is a piece of the earned income credit that says you don't qualify for it if you have too much investment income. And maybe that's a way of looking at people over 65 as being discriminated against. Again, it's a law that was passed with the conditions that are part of it. And you need, in most cases, children to get the credit that is larger. I guess it is under 65. I have been enlightened. Usually when they put things in for something like that, it's balancing a budget. And it's like the child tax credit only goes up to children under the age of 17. It's to balance the budget, to make people happy. That's all I can say is a reason beyond that.
Yeah. Dean emailed us. He's considering starting to do freelance writing work and then also working as an independent Uber Lyft driver. Wondering if you have advice for people considering working this way. What do they need to know about paying quarterly taxes and that kind of thing? Is there an earning threshold for when you have to pay estimated quarterly taxes?
Well, again, as I mentioned earlier about estimated tax payments, the IRS expects you to pay your taxes as you go through the year. When you're in a business that you don't have consistent income, a lot of times it's hard to guess what the bottom line is going to be at the end. And that's what makes it tough with earned income with guessing estimated tax payments. Now, obviously, when you're doing your tax return, if you're living only on the freelance and the Uber, you're not going to pay income tax unless you've made more than the standard deduction. And just in round figures, it's about $15,000. I know it's a little less than that for this year. About $15,000 is the standard for a single person, about $30,000 for a married couple. So that's kind of a range to tell you. But there is one other thing with freelance or being an independent contractor. The earnings subject to tax for Social Security purposes is around $400. And again, I'm giving you round numbers. But if you have earnings over that net profit of that amount, you may not owe income tax, but you might owe self-employment tax. And that's another reason that paying money in to cover the self-employment tax is important. So be sure you look at not only the income tax side, but also the self-employment tax, which is all covered on the individual's tax return. And the self-employment tax rate is 15.3%. And the Schedule SE does a calculation of 9.235% of your earnings, and then that's times 15.3%. So that's part of what you have to do. And as far as being self-employed, the best advice that I can give anybody is keep good records. Mileage records for the Uber is ultra important. Keep a log of when you're using your vehicle, when you start, when you end, what did you do that day? That's probably the most important advice.
A listener wonders if the IRS direct file also works for state taxes.
The direct file program is available in 24 states this year. The states had the opportunity to do it. It is my understanding that the state of Wisconsin is going along with the state as well as the federal program. I haven't seen a lot from Wisconsin on it yet, but it's my understanding that that's the way it is. I don't know about our surrounding states.
Paula sent us an email. She's inherits her husband's IRA in 2024. Does the 10-year rule apply to her for withdrawing the entire balance, for husband's balance? She was told she was the surviving spouse and the rule didn't apply to her.
Good question. We didn't get into that part of it before. The Secure Act made the 10-year rule for inherited IRAs with exceptions. And the surviving spouse is one of those exceptions. Also, a child under the age of 18. When they turn 18, then it picks up. A person who is not more than 10 years younger, I believe, is an exception. And also disabled people are exceptions to it.
Okay. Sandy sent us a question. Both parents passed away in 2024. Taxes are simple, so they normally do their own taxes using Tax Act. Sandy and their siblings inherited some of the financial investments and their property through a TOD deed. They have not sold the property. Should Sandy seek professional tax help this year?
Well, depending on the situation, if it was done through TOD and everything that mom and dad had was done through TOD, they may not be required to file an estate income tax return. A 706, that's inheritance tax, and it's $13,610,000 for 2024. So a lot of people don't have to worry about that. But if mom and dad, and I'm not sure who died and who inherited what, but if there were income received, if something weren't TOD and there was income received, they might have a 1041 filing. But assuming that that's the case, that everything was TOD, then the only thing that would be different is if there is additional income from any of these financial things, like retirement programs, they received any IRAs, or do they, if they inherited the accounts, you know, do they have RMDs that they have to take? Have they thought about the 10-year window for the retirement accounts? If it's brokerage accounts, did they get switched over? You know, have they gotten their share that might affect their tax return? If it's real estate and nothing's been done with the real estate as far as sale, that probably has no effect on this year's tax return until it's sold, other than real estate taxes or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to know without knowing exactly what it is. I'm always an advocate that seeking professional advice helps you find out maybe what you don't know.
Maggie is power of attorney for her mother, who spent the majority of the past year in a long-term care facility. Are there any tax deductions Maggie should be aware of for this or other medical expenses that Maggie can take advantage of?
Okay. First of all, we're talking two different things. Maggie is the POA for her mother. The only thing that, the only reason Maggie would have any consequences from her mother is if her mother were not able to pay the bills and Maggie and her mother were a dependent of Maggie. Other than that, Maggie's mother, because of the long-term care, if she's paying for it or paying long-term care insurance or having medical expenses, those could affect Maggie's mother's return. But the POA just says that Maggie has the right to act for her mother in her mother's place. And unless Maggie's receiving income for that service or something like that, there's probably nothing on Maggie's return that would be impacted by that.
And on that note, we, Mary, are out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure to have you here, and we'll look forward, I'm looking forward to talking with you again next month. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They've been doing it a long time, as you can tell from the way, the good way that she answers your questions and mine as well. Great to have her with us. She'll be back next month, and we'll do it again. Turning our attention to water now and private wells, and we'll talk about what you need to do with your private well. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about water now. About a quarter of Wisconsin's population drinks water drawn from private wells. I think it's a great way to get fresh water. That's assuming you maintain the system correctly. And we're going to be talking about getting your well water tested today with our guest, Marty Nessman. Marty is private water section manager at the DNR, and as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in, want to hear from you. Give us your questions about the well water testing process. Maybe you're a new homeowner. Are you wondering which labs to send your samples to? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Marty Nessman, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I was trying to do the math on this. I was trying to remember how many people we have in the state of Wisconsin. It was around 5 million, is it?
Around 5 million, yes.
And so how many of them are drinking from private wells? Over a million.
It would be over a million. There are over 800,000 wells in Wisconsin.
Wow. And why is it important to regularly sample your well water?
Well, one big reason is that private well owners are responsible for testing and maintaining their wells. There's no state requirement that anyone tests their well if it's a private well. And it's, you know, going to be their choice to decide which tests to do and actions to take.
But it's a good, probably a good thing to do.
It's definitely a good thing to do. While private wells do provide really high quality water in most cases, some do contain substances that affect our health. Testing is the only way to know what's in the water. A lot of contamination could be hard to detect by taste or smell or visually. So we definitely recommend that well owners complete tests once a year, especially for bacteria and nitrate, and then test their well for arsenic. That's our general recommendation, is to test for arsenic if you haven't tested it already.
So, yeah, and if you test it once for arsenic, should you do it again?
Yeah, you should test about once every 5 years. Make sure
for arsenic.
If you have a detection, you have arsenic in your water that's maybe close to the 10 milligram or micrograms per liter drinking water level, you should definitely test it more often. But every 5 years is a good recommendation to make sure you know what's in your water, arsenic wise.
And so, but for sure, for every year, you ought to be testing for
bacteria and nitrate.
Bacteria and nitrates. Okay. Well, I know last show we had somebody who just bought a home, and for the first time, a homeowner. Mm-hmm. For him and for anybody else who's sort of a new well owner out there, walk us through everything you need to do to test your well water.
Well, to test your water, it's a fairly simple process. You would contact a certified laboratory. And if you need to find a certified laboratory, all you have to do is search for well testing on our website. It's dnr.wisconsin.gov. And they will send you a kit. You sample the water, send it back to them. You're going to want to make sure you test from a tap that's not treated already, so it doesn't have some kind of treatment system on it already, so that you know what's coming out of your well and what's in your system.
And what do you get, a test tube or something? Or
They will send bottles. I think the bacteria bottle is about 40 milliliters of water. Nitrate is similar, maybe a little larger. But you just fill them up to the line and get them back to the laboratory, and they'll analyze it.
I'm not sure I would have wanted to have my well water in the mail today.
Not
or
today.
Or yesterday.
It's best if you can hand deliver it to the lab. If you mail it back, you got to make sure it's going to get there in time, because bacteria does have a shorter analysis hold time. So you want to get it there within 24 to 30 hours, and sometimes mailing it will not make it. And on a day like today, you'd probably want to put it in a bag with some ice, and that would insulate it from freezing today. So
yeah, for sure. The thing about this is, I'm thinking now, is the testing labs themselves. If if it's best to, do we have testing labs all over the state? And is it?
Yeah. There are testing labs throughout the state. On our website, they can list them by county. There are also many county health departments that have laboratories that do bacteria and nitrate. But there's no, as long as they're, qualified to do bacteria and nitrate analysis, you can take it to any lab that's out there.
And so now may not be the best time, but what's typically the best time?
Best time to sample?
Yeah.
I would say spring is always a nice time to sample because there's typically more rainfall, more infiltration. You should also sample anytime you notice a change in your water's taste, color, or smell. So that's a good time to sample as well, because it's most likely to be a change in water quality if you notice something like that.
And there are sometimes when the taste of or the smell doesn't mean a whole lot.
Sometimes not. Sometimes it does. It doesn't always mean that there's something harmful in the water, but it can mean that. Otherwise, it could mean there's something like a sulfur-degrading bacteria, which is generally harmless to humans, but can be a bit of a nuisance. It causes a rotten egg smell in your shower often. That's the most often you'd see.
Yeah, which you don't want to have. But I know there are certain areas, there's at least a couple areas that in the state that have that issue from time to time.
Yeah, certainly. It can be found just about anywhere.
Which areas of the state are most susceptible to groundwater problems?
Well, I think every area of the state has some susceptible areas. Anywhere where you're drawing from the very top of the aquifer, where there's shallow groundwater, and the travel time from the surface to your well is short, that tends to be a place where that could be. So the central sands can have some issues like that. Certainly the heavy industrial or agricultural uses, if you're in an area like that, nitrate is more likely to be found in heavy agriculture areas. There's different contamination found in different parts of the state, so it's hard to make a broad generalization on that, but certainly the central sands with nitrates is has been in the news, but it is kind of localized from place to place within that large geographic area.
I was trying to think of the typical depth, or if you own a home, you're sitting here, well, I've got this home, I've got a well, I don't even know how deep the well is.
Right.
Are there ways to check for that, or?
Well, there's a couple ways. We do have a web page where you can access the well construction records that we have and do a search. You can search by map or by address or location. If you don't find your well construction report there, you could have a licensed well driller or pump installer come out and measure the depth of your casing, depth of the well, depth of water. That certainly would give you the information you need to know to make a good decision about whether or not to use that well.
Well, I'm wondering, how deep you'd have to go to kind of get away from that surface.
Well, we have certain minimum standards for how deep well casing should be, and sand and gravel aquifers generally 25 feet or 10 feet below the water table. The deeper below the top of the water table you get, generally, the less likely you'll have things coming in from the near surface, but that can also send you down to other things that you may not want either. So from something like bacteria and nitrate, generally being at least 50 feet below the top of the water table will help that situation. It may not in all areas correct it.
Bruce in Greene County, your turn. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. So I bought a kit with the stripe with the piece of paper that you match up the colors from Amazon to do all this. It was very economical, very easy. Even I could do it. Is that justifiable as sending it to a laboratory somewhere?
Well, for certain things, it could give you a general idea. For like nitrate strips are used, I've heard, on occasion. They can give you, they're not as accurate as a laboratory analysis, but they can give you a general idea of if you're way below the standard of 10 milligrams per liter nitrate or way above it. So they can be useful as an indicator.
So if it indicates you're way above, you ought to be going and get it tested anyway.
Absolutely, yep.
And so when you get the test or when you get the results back, What appears in the paper?
Well, you should see the, the result. You should see some. Typically, the laboratories will send you a letter with the results, and it'll say what the standard is, the drinking water standard is, and whether it's above or below that.
Probably, yeah, hopefully zero in it. A little bit. If they say, well, it's below the standard because...
Well, they probably won't go into that, but they'll just say, you know, nitrate was detected at, let's say, 8. The standard is 10. You're below the standard. If it's above that, it'll indicate that it's above.
Steve in Rhinelander has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I have a question about new well construction. The DNR website has a list of over 200 chemical lubricants allowed for use when drilling a new well. And these chemicals are all made by petroleum companies like Halliburton. It could be that the PFAS contamination starts when the water wells are drilled. Is the DNR testing these petroleum-based chemicals to make sure they do not contain PFAS or other dangerous contaminants?
Steve, thanks for calling. What do you think, Marty?
Well, we're not testing them directly, but... there is a standard NSF 60 that is kind of used as a we use it to approve products for use in drilling wells in Wisconsin, and they do very detailed. They have a very detailed standard that the drilling fluid companies need to follow when they're manufacturing the chemicals. And so if any PFAS were in there, it wouldn't meet the standard. They wouldn't be NSF 60 certified. So we kind of use that to make sure that there isn't anything in there. I can't tell you that we have sampled a lot of new wells for PFAS lately, we are not finding levels of PFAS from any drilling fluids. Drilling fluids are seldom used in well drilling in Wisconsin, other than drilling mud, which is made from a bentonite product that doesn't have a lot of additives. So, and certainly not PFAS. PFAS wouldn't help drilling mud at all. So,
all right, there we go. And let's go to Jan in Middleton. Jan, hi.
Hi there. I recently bought a test kit online and wondering, because we live off of Highway 14 south of the Superfund site that is halfway between Middleton and Cross Plains, and our well, when we drilled it, this was like 40 years ago, was over 400 feet deep, so we're down deep, but we are also up on the moraine, and so I'm wondering what I need to test for, if there's anything specific other than the general test that everybody else sends in from the regular box thing that you get in the mail.
Okay.
Well, that's a hard question to answer because I'm not intimately familiar with that landfill Superfund site. But I know that the Superfund sites are monitored pretty frequently, and the remediation program would certainly be able to help you answer the question of if you should sample for anything. But if you haven't been contacted by the DNR or the responsible party for that Superfund site for testing, then they haven't detected anything near you where they would want to test your well. So I guess if you have any, if you look for that site on our webpage, if you just type in the name of it, you should be able to find resources to contact someone in the remediation program, and they could help you determine that.
Yeah, so just Wisconsin DNR and then type in Superfund sites? Or the specific one, yeah.
The specific one, yeah.
Jan, yeah, so you should be able to find out pretty quickly who to contact if you want to ask them for more specifics on it.
Yeah, because it's such a wide range of things that could be there that, you know, it's really good to narrow it down.
Yeah, makes sense. Jan, thank you for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at private wells today with our guest Marty Nesma. And Marty is the private water section manager at the DNR. Great to have him with us. And questions, give a call. Number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Dennis emailed a question. If air tests show radon is low, should water be tested anyway for radon?
Typically, we don't recommend people sample their water for radon. We would recommend it an air sample because that's the most dangerous exposure route, is really breathing in radon through the air or through vaporized water.
So you ought to be testing, and probably this time of the year is a good time to be doing it, testing for radon for sure in your home.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in the base, if you have basement in the basement of your home, it's a good time of the year to be doing that. And I don't know if you're familiar with radon test kits, but or have any, but
I haven't tested that. No.
Okay, so, yeah. But there are tests out there that you can do, and there are companies that'll do it for you.
Certainly,
for sure. Victoria sent us an email. She says she rents her apartment. Does her landlord have to test, or is that her responsibility? She noticed her water stinks after it sits for a day, and it also doesn't suds up well.
Okay. Your landlord probably is not required to, definitely not by the DNR. I guess we don't really regulate that part of it. It's not considered a public well because there's only, it's a single family home or it depends, actually, I should say.
Yeah, I was
depends on
say.
The size of the number of apartments that are there. If it's like a 4-unit apartment with a well, that wouldn't require regular sampling. But if he does sample, I mean, he should be able to provide you with results. So I would ask your landlord if he has done any sampling.
And if you're located in a city, you're probably on public. You may be on public water, Victoria,
right.
Which
yep.
That's a whole different thing. A municipality should be sending out information at least once a year. I think we get in Madison. We get at least once a year. I get a report on the quality of the water in the various wells around the city and the ones that I would be using. So there you go with that. Two emerging contaminants. PFAS has been in the headlines a lot. Maybe you could give us an overview of what it is and what we ought to be concerned with, and should we be testing for it?
Yeah, so PFAS is a family of chemicals. They're man-made. It's the technical names are perfluoroalkyl and polyfluoroalkyl substances. They're chemicals with many uses. They've been used in stain-resistant carpet and fabric, nonstick cookware, firefighting foam, fast food packaging. They're everywhere in the environment. So what makes PFAS kind of challenging is that they can be found just about anywhere. Some of the PFAS can affect your health at low levels. So right now we're recommending that you consider testing for PFAS if you live near a known PFAS site. There are some firefighting foam sites around the state. There are also some areas where it's been detected in municipal wells or other sampling that's been conducted. So, and you can find those on our website as well.
Sure. Eric in De Pere called, couldn't stay with us. He's a real estate agent and wondering which tests he should recommend to clients looking to buying a home with a well.
Yeah. So there are a couple things. related to that. So, you know, it's not required that any sampling be done when you're buying a house with a well. But if you do ask for an inspection of your well, which we recommend, prior to buying the house, that inspection has to be done by a licensed well driller or pump installer, and they have to sample for bacteria, nitrate, and arsenic as part of that inspection. So a general recommendation would be bacteria, nitrate, arsenic. Some lenders will require lead sampling as well or other samples to be collected. But those are the requirements and the general recommendation.
Yeah, that was a good question. Eric, thanks for that question. Barney wonders if, and this is an email, if bacteria in well water could be a sign the well pump needs replacing.
Not necessarily. It could mean many things, but it could mean that there is an opening into the well. It could be through the water line between the house and the well, could be in the well casing itself, could be the well cap, or typically like the electrical conduit that comes out of the well cap and goes into the ground. Often that cracks, and if it's not sealed above that crack, then insects and even rodents can get in the well, and that would cause a bacteria issue.
Oh my goodness.
I've seen it.
What about manganese? Does that ever come up as an issue?
Yeah, manganese, you know, is a naturally occurring element, but it's part of a healthy diet, but it can affect your health at very high levels. So we generally recommend testing for manganese if your water is brown or rust black, or if it stains your faucets, sinks, or laundry, or if you notice kind of an off taste or odor to your water.
And health effects, if you're getting too much of it?
There are certain effects, especially in children that are puberty age. There can be some developmental issues. I don't have all of the health effects off the top of my head, but it's generally not healthy for certain groups to have high manganese.
Pete in Crandon called, couldn't stay with us. He says the DNR put a sticker on his well that says, in quotes, unique well.
Yep.
What does that mean? He wondered.
So that's your unique well number. You can use that number to look up your well construction report. We assign every new well a unique well number so that if it's sampled in the future or if something happens with that well down the line, you can find your well construction report. You can find sometimes some analytical data that have been collected from that well.
And somebody else wondered, does boiling water remove the contaminants?
So boiling water can help get rid of bacteria. It'll kill bacteria in water, but it won't affect other contaminants, and oftentimes it'll concentrate the contaminants if you boil the water because you're removing the actual...
The water.
Good water.
The
pure water is evaporating, and the rest is just concentrating the contaminants more.
Not a good idea. And just last but not least, what can in-home water treatment filters, can they help?
Certainly. There are many treatment companies in Wisconsin and throughout the country that can treat for any contamination, nitrate, arsenic, lead. You just want to make sure you get the right one and that you maintain it.
Marty, the half hour flew by. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm happy to do it. Thank you.
Marty Nessman, Private Wells Section Manager at the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have him with us. And thank you for joining in today. And thanks to our whole team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our producers, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.